with God's name, the merciful benefactor, the merciful redeemer. This is John Nasheed, New Mind Development Project. Peace be upon you all. And we thank God for blessing us with health and strength today. And we know this is the day of the Super Bowl, and everybody is going out getting their potato chips and popcorn and beer and soda and things of that nature. And just be mindful, because the excitement of the time, you know, anytime there's great excitement in the atmosphere, there's opportunists, people who take advantage. So, you know, just keep these things in mind. The topic we'd like to speak on a little today is Valentine. Be my Valentine, Valentine's Day. And Valentine Day comes about February 14th. And Valentine's Day represents the strong feeling of love. Suggests sex, represents love. Love could come in many different forms, but I believe that the suggestion is bordering around sex, you know, red roses, chocolates and heart-shaped boxes, female underwear, undergarments as gifts, sex, romance, and wine, the wining and dining. And what is this for? It's all about an introduction to sex. In the history, the 6th century BC, pagan Roman festival. It was a pagan Roman festival. I don't know how many of us saw movies of the pagan times in Rome and the people drinking wine and having open sex and just carrying on. And, you know, just for what purpose? Facilitating fertility. Fertility is producing offspring. It was like animal sacrifice and women abuse. All of these things were going on at that particular time. Actually, also in the time of our Prophet Muhammad, over 1400 years ago, in the Jahiliyyah period, the period of darkness and ignorance, same thing was taking place. People were going around the Kaaba in their ignorance before Islam came to them, naked and having sex right in the open. You know, so these things are in the nature of human beings that's not reformed. But once the human life comes to be reformed, then life begins to change. So this savagery, the savagery of lust, and look how people have sex today. It's animal-like. You know, sometimes you see things or events that take place. People go to court, and some of the things that's done in a sexual encounter is not even human. It's animal. Things that people do today, these devices that they use on themselves, etc. And this is all in the name of love. And I personally believe that Valentine's Day enhances that. It gives it more energy, more spirit to go about that animal lust. And in the 5th century, there was a pope who replaced the pagan practice and declared this November 14th, Valentine's Day. Matter of fact, Saint Valentine's Day, instead of that Roman practice, they honored a Roman priest. So that's about where we are today. But today, it had changed from anything in the past, anything about love and all the rest of those kinds of things, and then it's centered more so today in commercial opportunities. Nothing to do with the past. And how do we know that? Well, we can go and look in the markets, the flowers, the place that sell cards, etc. And you see the shelves are filled with merchandise. They say that Valentine's Day this year, 2022, there's going to be spent on Valentine's Day $23.9 billion. That's a lot of money. In the schools, I remember when we were children, we used to make Valentine cards. They had red paper, white paper, And we cut these things out and we gave them to each other, say Happy Valentine's Day, expressing feeling of love, etc., right? And the same thing we do for our mother. Now, Valentine cards, you might pay $5, $3, $4, $5, $10 for a card. And God only knows how much for flowers and roses and chocolates and all the rest of these things. Keep in mind, $23.9 billion this year. That's what's going to be spent. And the hard times, people out of work, etc. But we support these things. And then keep in mind also that America have many, many holidays that monies have to be spent to celebrate. And in the past, red represented blood sacrifice and lust and pagan sacrifice. Today, it represents, in the church, Christ's love. So these things we have to consider in our mind and in our thinking before we participate in any practice. And some of us are religion of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, whatever religion that we belong to. But if you decide to participate in Valentine's Day for whatever reason, you have to keep in mind that love is always love. That's how God created us. He created us in love. He created us in the best mold. You can't enhance that. You know, these things are items or material items that we try to bring into the picture. Just give our heart, our personal heart, to one another. And if we do that, then quite naturally we're going to be blessed. And then we'll see the world begin to change and we'll have what we all say we're striving for, peace on earth and goodwill to men. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Small number into the system with economic enticements. There was talk of black capitalism. Leaders of the NAACP and CORE were invited to the White House. James Farmer of CORE, a former freedom writer and militant, was given a job in President Nixon's administration. Floyd McKissick of CORE received a $14 million government loan to build a housing development in North Carolina. Lyndon Johnson had given jobs to some blacks through the Office of Economic Opportunity. Nixon set up an Office of Minority Business Enterprise. Chase Manhattan Bank and the Rockefeller family, controllers of Chase, took a special interest in developing black capitalism. The Rockefellers had always been financial patrons of the Urban League and a strong influence in black education through their support of Negro colleges in the South. David Rockefeller tried to persuade his fellow capitalists that while helping black businessmen with money might not be fruitful in the short run, it was necessary to shape an environment in which the business can continue earning a profit 4 or 5 or 10 years from now. With all of this, black business remained infinitesimally small. The largest black corporation, Motown Industries, had sales in 1974 of $45 million, while Exxon Corporation had sales of $42 billion. The total receipts of black-owned firms accounted for 0.3% of all business income. There was a small amount of change and a lot of publicity. There were more black faces in the newspapers and on television, creating an impression of change and siphoning off into the mainstream a small but significant number of black leaders. Some new black voices spoke against this. Robert Allen, Black Awakening in Capitalist America, wrote, "If the community as a whole is to benefit, then the community as a whole must be organized to manage collectively its internal economy and its business relations with white America. Black business firms must be treated and operated as social property belonging to the general black community, not as the private property of individual or limited groups of individuals. This necessitates the dismantling of capitalist property relations in the black community and their replacement with a planned communal economy." A black woman, Patricia Robinson, in a pamphlet distributed in Boston in 1970, "Poor Black Woman," tied male supremacy to capitalism and said the black woman allies herself with the have-nots in the wider world and their revolutionary struggles. She said the poor black woman did not in the past question the social and economic system, but now she must, and in fact, she has begun to question aggressive male domination and the class society which enforces it, capitalism. Another black woman, Margaret Wright, said she was not fighting for equality with men if it meant equality in the world of killing, the world of competition. I don't want to compete on no damned exploitative level. I don't want to exploit nobody. I want the right to be black and me. The system was working hard by the late 60s and early 70s to contain the frightening explosiveness of the black upsurge. Blacks were voting in large numbers in the South, and in the 1968 Democratic Convention, three blacks were admitted into the Mississippi delegation. By 1977, more than 2,000 blacks held office in 11 southern states. In 1965, the number was 72. There were two congressmen, 11 state senators, 95 state representatives, 267 county commissioners, 76 mayors, 824 city council members, 18 sheriffs or chiefs of police, 508 school board members. It was a dramatic advance. But blacks, with 20% of the South's population, still held less than 3% of the elective offices. A New York Times reporter analyzing the new situation in 1977 pointed out that even where blacks held important city offices, whites almost always retain economic power. After Maynard Jackson, a black, became mayor of Atlanta, the white business establishment continued to exert its influence. Those blacks in the South who could afford to go to downtown restaurants and hotels were no longer barred because of their race. More blacks could go to colleges and universities, to law schools and medical schools. Northern cities were busing children back and forth in an attempt to create racially mixed schools, despite the racial segregation in housing. None of this, however, was halting what Francis Piven and Richard Cloward, poor people's movements, called the destruction of the black lower class, the unemployment, the deterioration of the ghetto, the rising crime, drug addiction, violence. In the summer of 1977, the Department of Labor reported that the rate of unemployment among black youths was 34.8%. A small, new, black middle class of blacks had been created, and it raised the overall statistics for black income. But there was a great disparity between the newly risen middle class black and the poor left behind. Despite the new opportunities for a small number of blacks, the median black family income of 1977 was only about 60% that of whites. Blacks were twice as likely to die of diabetes, seven times as likely to be victims of homicidal violence rising out of the poverty and despair of the ghetto. A New York Times report in early 1978 said, "The places that experienced urban riots in the 1960s have, with a few exceptions, changed little, and the conditions of poverty have spread in most cities." Statistics did not tell the whole story. Racism, always a national fact, not just a southern one, emerged in northern cities as the federal government made concessions to poor blacks in a way that pitted them against poor whites for resources made scarce by the system. Blacks, freed from slavery to take their place under capitalism, had long been forced into conflict with whites for scarce jobs. Now, with desegregation in housing, blacks tried to move into neighborhoods where whites themselves, poor, crowded, troubled, could find in them a target for their anger. In the Boston Globe, November 1977, a Hispanic family of six fled their apartment in the Seven Hills section of Dorchester yesterday after a week of repeated stonings and window smashings by a group of white youths in what appears to have been racially motivated attacks.